From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They disagree on profound social issues, and their religious views are at least a messiah apart. But the Christian right and Jewish communities have taken a high-profile stand together lately in their steadfast support of Israel. Security concerns, Scripture, and the Judeo-Christian tradition bind evangelicals, Israel, and Jews together. But the group's separate traditions can make strange bedfellows. Some leaders of the Christian right are far harder-nosed than Israel's or America's Jewish mainstream, denouncing wholesale diplomacy as a solution and calling for the removal of Palestinians from the West Bank. Behind the United Front, values can part company and visions certainly do. Christian evangelical readings of the Bible foresee the ultimate conversion or destruction of Israel's Jews. For some, that is distant prophecy. For others, the second coming is an everyday motivation. Today, I spoke with two figures directly involved in this interfaith alliance who have stark differences over its ultimate purpose. Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein is founder and president of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews in Jerusalem. Dr. James Hutchins is a pastor and president of Christians for Israel, USA, in Washington, D.C., an organization devoted to helping others to understand God's heart and purposes for His chosen people. I asked Jim Hutchins to explain the importance of Israel in the biblical prophecies surrounding the second coming of Christ.
Well, the prophets speak of a return to the land. Ezekiel chapter 36, for example, speaks of ingathering from the nations of the Jewish people, and that then there is to be a spiritual renewal that takes place. And as Christians, we believe that renewal will be surrounded by the coming of Christ.
Now, specifically, how does the Temple Mount come into that narrative, that series of events?
The Temple Mount in the New Testament, there are allusions to that. Jesus made reference to it, that when you see certain things take place in the temple, presupposing the existence of a temple, the scriptures are clear that there will be some kind of a sacrificial system, worship system, that is reinstituted in the end times.
And then in the end times, as you describe them, what happens to that third temple, and what are the series of events that lead to the second coming of Christ?
My understanding of the next thing to see is a covenant that is confirmed by a world leader. It's the Daniel 9:27 covenant that is confirmed by a world leader that grants certain existence, certain contingencies to evidently the Jewish people. It evidently has implications of peace for at least a 3.5-year period.
And then?
And then this covenant is broken by this person. He exalts himself as deity.
And this is the so-called Antichrist.
That's the Antichrist.
Who would be exalted in the third temple, that is the third temple of the Jews. And then in your interpretation of the biblical prophecy, what's the resolution of that situation?
Well, then comes a time that Jesus spoke of in Matthew chapter 24 of an unprecedented time of affliction, the likes of which the world has not experienced.
And this is talked about as the tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And is this where the devastation of Israel comes in?
Well, that's where an all-out siege is placed upon Israel. But Zechariah tells us that that is an unsuccessful siege.
Then what is the fate of all the people involved at that time?
Well, those who stand in opposition to God and His Messiah are destroyed. It's a cataclysmic event. It's spoken of as though it's a nuclear exchange in some places.
And what will be the fate of Christians at that time?
It says they are caught up to meet the Lord in the air, and there's evidently a change that takes place. Paul speaks of a momentary change, in a moment in the twinkling of an eye, there's a change, and that they come, return to the earth with Christ, and they rule and reign with Him for 1,000 years.
And what would happen to Jews at that time?
There would be many of those who acknowledge their Messiah.
In other words, they would acknowledge Jesus Christ as their Messiah.
That's our belief.
And those Jews and others who would not acknowledge Christ as their Messiah?
Those who stand in opposition to God and His Messiah at that point are destroyed. This is cataclysmic.
I want to turn to Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein, joining us from Israel. Rabbi Eckstein, much has been made in recent weeks of the support of Christian fundamentalists in the United States for Israel. When I hear this biblical prophecy, or when you hear it, how does it make you feel to be allied with a very supportive group that also, in its scriptural interpretation, foresees the destruction of Jews who do not accept Christ.
Well, frankly, I hope that you have, and I know that ministry, and I know him, Jim, and frankly, it's very scary. And as much as we agree on many things, having heard him over these past few minutes, I'm frankly a little bit abhorred. We don't stand together on a lot of things that he said. The first point that I would want to make is that evangelical views in general on eschatology, future day scenarios, and on their support of Israel have varied bases and motivations. And what you just heard was one very particular one that I can now comment on.
Well, granted, this is Mr. Hutchins, and I want to hear your comment, but before we go to that, and I should say this pretty much lines up with what we've read Reverend Jerry Falwell, quite a prominent evangelical, describing. Jim Hutchins, are you kind of a fringe fundamentalist? Do you agree with the rabbi that you're on the sort of outer bounds in your interpretation of the Bible?
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't agree with that. I think, by and large, the evangelicals, and I would consider myself a historic pre-mill. And that means that Christ is coming before the millennium and sets up his kingdom before the millennium.
And
But that does not mean that God's people are raptured out before that.
But does that make you unusual or a tiny minority among?
No, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, it's among the pre-mills that you will find that a disassociation with replacement theology. Pre-mills do not believe that Christians have replaced, by and large, do not believe that Christians have replaced Israel or the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And I certainly don't believe that. I think there is a covenant that still stands, and that's why we're so strongly supportive of Israel today.
Let me explain where I think we, both personally and knowing that ministry and knowing him, and then the Jewish community can agree, and where I believe that not only do we part, but also that it parts with even other mainline evangelicals.
All right.
Firstly, when we talk about the ingathering of the Jewish people and our ministry, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, our organization, which has brought over 200,000 Jews from the former Soviet Union, Ethiopia, Argentina,
yes,
to Israel, it is motivated by the desire to fulfill prophecy that I, as an Orthodox Jew, believe that is taking place, that the prophets talked about a day when the Jewish people would return from the four corners of the world to Israel, establish the land, and I think we agree on that dimension, that prophecy dimension.
What is it in what Jim Hutchins said that you abhor?
What I abhor, firstly, is the I shouldn't use the word abhor for this first part. Where we differ fundamentally is in our approach to prophecy. Jews do not look ahead with prophecy, as Jim and some premillennialists do, in saying, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. I know that because it says this in Zechariah, and this in Daniel, and this in the book of Matthew. Now, where we agree is we Jews will look back at history and look at the events of today and see God's footprints in that. At least the religious Jew will see that. But where I want to stress we have our shared commitment is, and I think if Jim were to comment on this, I think he would agree, that the primary motivation that Christians have in standing in solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people, in addition to the humanitarian, in addition to the fight against anti-Semitism, the biblical one is that Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, that God promises that those who bless his people, Israel, will be blessed, and that the Jewish people are to be blessed in that sense and to be stood next to, and even, if you will, many put us on a pedestal. That is the primary motivation where, if you will, we can buy into that, but where we try to apply future-day prophecies eschatologically to current-day scenarios with definitiveness and glibness is where we part ways.
Jim Hutchins, Yehiel Eckstein seems very open to the Christian fundamentalist embrace today, but rejects the prophecy surrounding the second coming
that
you described.
Well, he does, and I know the rabbi, and I appreciate his stand, and he knows our organization, Christians for Israel. And I would say, I would agree that Genesis 12:3 is a motivating factor. But I think we've been involved in bringing Jews back from portions of the Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. We're involved in Argentina. Over 70,000 Jews we've helped to bring back out
the
of
the in-gathering, as you describe it.
The in-gathering, right. But there is a mandate that we believe that we have, not just because we believe that it will be blessed, but there is a mandate. Isaiah says, I will beckon to the Gentiles. I will lift up my banner to the peoples, and they will bring your sons in their arms. They will gather, carry your daughters on their shoulders. There is a specific mandate.
What does that mean?
That means that the Gentiles, non-Jews, are to assist in this ingathering, that they have a major role to play in this. I would differ from the rabbi's description of a glib response to prophetic scriptures. We have a consistent view of the prophetic scriptures. We both buy into this Isaiah passage to say that we have a mandate. We take that literally. But in addition to that, as evangelical Christians, we take literally and have a literal hermeneutic when we come to the New Testament as well, and with regard to the prophecies, with regard to the temple and the unprecedented tribulation that will come.
Let me tell you the problem here. And again, why people should not misunderstand what's going on. George Bush is an evangelical Christian.
Mm-hmm.
If I, as an American citizen, believe that my president knew for a reality what was going to be, that this is going to happen, then I certainly would be very, very reluctant to vote for that person or to see him in office, because when you believe that this not can happen, what Jim was saying is he's sure this will happen. He's not sure of when it will happen, how it will happen, but he's absolutely sure that it will happen. If I
Rabbi, I'm as sure that will happen as I am that there will be a successful ingathering and regathering that's taking place that you and I both have been involved in.
As sure of what, Jim Hutchins? You're as sure of what?
Of what will take place in the future as what is taking place now. As
That is the second coming of Christ and the uplifting of the Christians and so on.
That's right, the uplifting.
What I'm talking about specifically in terms of future day scenarios is this speaking and articulation with such certainty and assuredness, and I would use the word glibness, that, and the book of Revelation talks of how the blood in Armageddon of the people will rise so high as to reach the horses, the mantle, it to speak in that.
And whose
way,
blood would that be?
Those are in opposition to God.
And I assume that they, in the Jewish people, continuing to affirm our covenant, and I assume that that blood is, and it's generally kind of quietly referring to the Jewish blood. I mean, Jim spoke about the destruction of he didn't give numbers, but
we don't give numbers, but the destruction that lays waste is a worldwide destruction.
Jim, my point is, after the Holocaust, such talk is obscene. And there is a difference between a theological view and one that takes that and actually starts to apply it into the political reality. And
gentlemen, I'm sorry, we're out of time at this end. Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein, I want to thank you for joining us.
Sorry, I was so passionate there.
No need to be sorry. And Jim Hutchins, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Dr. James M. Hutchins is a pastor and president of Christians for Israel, USA. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Rabbi Yehiel Eckstein is founder and president of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. He joined us from Jerusalem. We're discussing the Christian Right's ardent backing of Israel and the strengths and peculiarities in the alliance of evangelicals and Jews. How do you interpret this mutual embrace? What does the alliance mean for Christians, Jews, and Muslims? What does it mean for Israel and for U.S. policy in the Middle East? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and the evangelicals. American Christian fundamentalists have come out as especially ardent supporters of Israel in Israel's time of trial in the last year of the increasing violence of the Intifada. What do you make of the alliance of Israel, Jews, and America's Christian fundamentalists? Is this, in your mind, a natural alliance or strange bedfellows? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Peter Beinart. He's editor of The New Republic. Good evening and welcome, Peter Beinart.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Peter, you just listened along with us to this, I think, rather extraordinary exchange between a rabbi in Jerusalem and a Christian evangelical fundamentalist in Washington over the kind of scriptural angles that come into play when you begin to look into this alliance. And it's not all a pretty picture.
No, it's not. It was a fascinating discussion that you led, but I must say, in a way, kind of pornographic. I mean, the truth is that almost anyone's theology, particularly the eschatological parts of their theology, when you really get into it, and I think this would go for Jewish theology as well, can sound crazy or deeply disturbing taken out of context. And I really don't think that debate, while it was fascinating that we listened to earlier, is really very germane to the debate about Israel and American politics today, because ultimately that debate has to take place within a moral framework that is acceptable and accessible to all people, regardless of whether they're Jews, Christians, or believers, not at all.
Well, I agree. Context is everything here. But of course, if you sit in the churches where the fundamentalists who make up the numbers, who back these positions are, this is hardly an unusual line of conversation or teaching.
That's true, but I don't think it ultimately matters. It only matters what you believe will happen at the end of days, if that is your own theological belief.
Fair enough.
If you don't come from that perspective, which Rabbi Eckstein and I also happen not to come from, mm-hmm. The only thing that really matters, I think, about the Christian right is what today it's saying our policy towards Israel should be. Where I have concerns about the Christian right's support for Israel doesn't have anything to do with what they believe at the end of the day, at the end of times, will come with Christ's return. It's about what policies they support now in the here and now politically, and I think that's where the more constructive debate can happen.
Where are your concerns there, Peter Beinart?
My concerns are that there is a really remarkably disturbing willingness amongst prominent Christian right leaders to support what's known in Israel as transfer, which is the physical removal of the Palestinians from the West Bank to somewhere else, probably in the Arab world. That is taboo in mainstream Israeli politics. It's taboo within the mainstream Zionist tradition. And yet I think because many prominent Christian right leaders don't understand that tradition and actually come from a very different standpoint morally, they are actually injecting things into the political debate that I think no Zionist, no Israeli, no Jew in good conscience could support.
And we didn't get to hear that, but I know that Pastor Jim Hutchins, President of Christians for Israel USA, who we heard earlier, is very much in support of that dispersal of Palestinians from the West Bank. He cites Dick Armey's recent comments and agrees with them. And in his own terms, he's all in favor of moving Palestinians out.
Yeah, and then this is where the problem comes, because let me refer us to a very secular term, ethnic cleansing. That's what that is. And I would say that no Jew in the shadow of the Holocaust could support the physical transport of Palestinians out of the West Bank, regardless of what you think the ultimate political solution should be. And I would hope that no person of any religious belief would support that, because it's horrifically immoral. And this is my concern about the Christian right. Not its eschatology, but that it comes at this issue in some ways so much from out of its concern for Jewish rights and its theological predisposition to believe that Jews have a right, that I think it is sometimes blinded to the moral questions that are involved for all people, Jews and Palestinians.
So how do you make the balance, or is it even proper to make a balance then between the very real political support that this group brings to Israel right now and the kind of tricky moral issues that you raise?
I would say that in the long term, and I know it's difficult for many American Jews to even think of a long term today, it is going to be destructive for American Jews to make an alliance with people unless they make it clear that that alliance has to reject transfer. In Israel, for instance, when
transfer meaning movement of Palestinians out,
meaning the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in Israel, when Meir Kahane's Kach party supported that position, it was banned as racist. In Israel, it is considered taboo, and I think it's important that we reestablish that taboo, because while there may be some short-term value in having that support, I think ultimately American Jews actually have to explain to the Christian right that these are not the right terms with which to support the state of Israel.
Let's look at the eschatology issue for just a second. And I understand your unease with the conversation we heard before, and yet you know exactly the perspectives that this conversation comes from. Is it really irrelevant if an ally has that kind of narrative running in the back of their mind? To you, as a journalist, as a Jewish writer, is it really irrelevant?
Well, I think it's unfair to I think it's unfair to expect that people's theology will abide by liberal norms. I think it's important to expect that people's politics will abide by liberal norms. But
of course, there are many Christians whose theology does abide by liberal norms.
Yes, that's right. But there are many Jews, and in fact, one might even say the mainstream Orthodox Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. if looked closely, its own theology dramatically violates what one would consider liberal norms. And I think this is the problem. I think you can find that in any religion. And I think it's important that we all recognize that while theology is a fascinating and important topic, and it gives great meaning to some of our lives, that it's fundamentally a different conversation from politics, and that it's unfair. I don't judge a Christian for believing that I, as a Jew, should accept Jesus Christ. I think that's part of what it means to be a Christian.
Okay.
I would also expect that Christians therefore wouldn't judge me as a Jew for believing that it would violate mm-hmm. my covenant to marry a Christian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about you've written that at a time of such peril for Israel that the issues of the nativity scene on the State House lawn and other social and political issues that have traditionally been sort of dividing lines between evangelical Christians and mainstream American Jews, that those can be set aside, that those are less important. Do you have any concern about putting those political issues aside? Is the choice that clear?
Well, it's not that clear, but I actually, my own personal view is that the American Jewish community has always been a little too paranoid about the Christian right on some of these church and state issues. And the reason is that I actually think my reading of the political trends among the Christian right is that the trend is not towards the attempt to take over the state and mm-hmm. transform America. It's actually, the trend is towards trying to retreat from the state. I think what most Christian rights want, Christian conservatives today want, is to carve out a space of their own separate from mainstream culture, so they feel like it won't pollute them. And so for that reason, I actually think that American Jews have perhaps made a little too much of some of these church-state issues, not to say they're irrelevant. And of course, Jews and Christian conservatives, as a practical matter, are very divided over other issues too. For instance, there's a dramatic disagreement about abortion, mm-hmm. even though that doesn't have theological roots. I mean, the Jewish theology on abortion is complex and perhaps not as clear-cut as evangelical, but it's not clearly pro-choice, but as a demographic, sociological issue, Jews and Christian rights and Christian conservatives are probably divided more by abortion than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think those are important issues, but I think it's acceptable to right now to place Israel at the center of the discussion.
It would be, but for, in your mind, this issue of evangelicals who say, just push the Palestinians out. This is Israel. It's the land for God's chosen people. You call that ethnic cleansing, even if they call it something else.
Yes, and I think that many Christian conservatives will say they support Israel not for theological reasons, but because of their belief in democracy, for instance. And this is mm-hmm. a claim that you hear a lot, but of which I'm quite suspicious, frankly, because this is a radically anti-democratic proposal that is being made on Israel's behalf. And I frankly don't think the Christian right has a very good record globally of being supporters of democracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it certainly was not Christian conservatives who one heard up in arms when the Bush administration supported a coup recently in Venezuela, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm suspicious of claims that it's really done because of some belief in democratic principle. And that's why I want the Christian right to essentially be forced to explain the terms of its support for Israel. Mm.
Peter Beinart, editor of The New Republic, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Ralph Reed. Ralph Reed is chairman of the Georgia Republican Party and was former Lee, Executive Director of the Christian Coalition. Good evening and welcome, Ralph Reed.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Ralph Reed, you've heard, I think, listening in, some of Peter Beinart's concerns about the embrace between Israel and American Christian evangelicals. What's your response? Is there anything for Peter Beinart to be concerned about here?
No, I don't think so. And while I heard parts of it, I don't want to specify my comments to his remarks. But I feel that that a lot of the suspicion and fear of the support of Israel among religious conservatives, including evangelicals, is based upon a caricature of their own views. I can tell you that I grew up in a Christian home in Miami, Florida. Went to a public school that was 40% Jewish, grew up going to, you know, bar mitzvahs and brisks, and I was pro-Israel for as long as I can remember. I was pro-Israel before I made any profession of faith in my own faith. And when I came to Washington in the early 1980s and got involved in pro-Jewish and pro-Israel causes and organizations, it had absolutely nothing to do with my theology. And to this day, it does not. I mean,
but you well know, Ralph Reed, that there are many evangelical Christians who do see their support for Israel intimately linked to their theological view of the world.
I just simply don't agree with that. And I've been active in this community for 25 years. And unless I'm listening to a debate like this, I don't hear it. I mean, I'm out there moving in this community every day, organizing it in support of Israel. And what I hear is something quite different, which is regardless of one's views on eschatology, and frankly, there are as many views on that as there are denominations and churches, I think what people feel is a very strong spiritual connection with Israel because it is the birthplace and the cradle of both the Jewish and the Christian faiths. That is very different than saying, I have to support the modern state of Israel to have my version of the end times come about. So for millions of Christians, for example, prior to the state of Israel gaining control of East Jerusalem in 1967, unfettered and open access to the sites of their faith, as well as the Jewish faith, was very difficult.
The Western Wall and so on.
Right. And the site that many Christians believe is where Christ was crucified and so forth. And I think it's an issue of international stability as well as human rights to allow people to have access to those sites.
And what about the particular point that I don't know if you heard or not that Peter Beinart made, his concern that evangelicals have expressed openness to or support for removing Palestinians from the West Bank because the promised land goes to of Israel goes to the Jews, and they'd be happy to see them dispersed to Jordan or elsewhere in the Arab world. Peter Beinart describes this as ethnic cleansing and sees it living in the midst of the evangelicals' support for Israel today.
I don't agree with that either. In fact, I would argue that that view is remarkable only for being exceptional.
Peter Beinart, how about that? Do you see it as exceptional, and do you buy Ralph Reed's kind of, you know, motherhood and apple pie characterization of evangelical support for Israel?
Well, I think there's a lot in what Ralph Reed said that I agree with, and I think he's always been one of the most attractive and articulate spokesmen for the Christian right. I actually do agree that Jews have a tendency to caricature as does the mainstream media, Christian conservatives. But I don't think that that support for transfer or ethnic cleansing is a marginal position amongst Christian conservatives, not if you judge by the fact that Dick Armey, Janet Parshall, who's the only Christian conservative who spoke at the massive pro-Israel rally a few weeks ago, and Jerry Falwell have all made statements that can only be read as supportive of that position. And I think that there is a problem because most Christian conservatives, I think, regardless of the degree to which theology is in their minds when they make these arguments, essentially believe that Israel's claim to the West Bank is not strategic, it's biblical, which leads them to believe that Israel must retain all of the West Bank. And if you believe that, which is, I think, a fringe position, it leads you to some very difficult problems about what you do with the Palestinians. And that is the kind of the logic that I think some important Christian conservative leaders have found themselves falling into in recent weeks and months.
Ralph Reed?
You know, just a couple of points. I mean, first of all, Dick Armey issued a statement the next morning and said, if I left the impression through my remarks that should be U.S. policy, I was wrong and I retract.
But there was no way to read his statement. His statement was not in
I would not deny that he shouldn't have said it. I'm just trying to make the point that the next morning he retracted it.
Retracted, but it was pretty well laid out and pretty clearly laid out on air.
I read the transcript. I'm just trying to make the point.
Understood. Point taken.
He has completely disavowed those statements. That's number one. Number two, I don't believe that the comments of a radio talk show host it represents the views of mainstream evangelicals.
What are you referring to there, Ralph?
I mean, Janet's a friend of mine. I respect her, but I don't think it's fair to state that is the view of mainstream evangelical
this
America.
Janet Parshall, the former spokesperson for the Family Research Council, fairly prominent in the fundamentalist world.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I don't believe that comment is representative of the community.
And Jerry Falwell said it in April.
And I work in this community every day and have for 20 years. And the fact is that I think what's happening here is I think some people are having second thoughts about who Israel's friends are, because either they don't agree with their domestic politics or they don't agree with their theology. So they are attempting to stigmatize their support for Israel by suggesting it is based on theology with which they disagree. And what I'm telling you is, not only do I not believe that's the case, but I don't appreciate, as someone who is a very strong supporter of Israel, based on nothing connected to my theology or my view of the end times, to have those views associated with me or my faith.
Well, Ralph, we hear that sincerity and we don't doubt it for a second, and yet we also hear real voices of real Christians speaking up with a very strong theological element. We've heard them tonight.
Yeah, and I've never denied, nor would I suggest otherwise tonight, that those views are not out there. What I'm arguing is that, if you look at things, for example, like the Bible studies across America where people read the works of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, if you look at the fact that Israel, regardless of what your views on the end times are, has been one of the most reliable and faithful allies of the United States during the Cold War, during Desert Storm, and during the current war against terrorism in the last 50 years. There is an historical and natural friendship and relationship between these two states. And I believe that the theology is not only overstated, but it is caricatured.
Well, caricatured then, we can see at some points, by fundamentalists themselves. Ralph Reed, Peter Beinart, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Israel and the evangelicals. What does it mean for Israel to ally so strongly with the Christian right? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel and the embrace of Israel by America's Christian evangelicals. Always have been supporters of Israel in recent months, in the time of Israel's terrific trial, have emerged as real stalwart supporters. The question is, if the security alliance is strong, does it matter if political and social agendas may differ? What does it mean for Israel to ally so strongly with America's Christian right? We're joined by Peter Beinart, he's editor of The New Republic, and Ralph Reed, who's chairman of Georgia's Republican Party and former executive director of the Christian Coalition. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Yaakov is on the line. Welcome, Yaakov. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hi. I am a religious Jew, and I love and support the land of Israel. And I welcome the support of the evangelical Christians, even though my theology is somewhat different from theirs.
Is it a wholehearted welcome, Yaakov, or do you have misgivings in any at all?
No. I was about to say, my theology differs from theirs, mm-hmm. that as a religious Jew, I also believe in the coming of a Messiah, but the Messiah that I believe in will be a Jewish Messiah who will usher in an age of peace and tranquility, for the, not just for the Jews, but for the entire world, mm-hmm. an age where there will be no more war. So, obviously, my theology disagrees with that of the evangelicals, but nevertheless, I think that all Jews, who especially Jews who support Israel, have to welcome and support the help that we can get from the evangelicals, because there's plenty of anti-Semitism mm-hmm. in this country, there's plenty of anti-Israel feeling in this country, and if we can get a group of 60 or 70 million Christians to come out and say, we want to Israel, then I think we have to welcome that support.
Yaakov, what about Peter Beinart's concern that some leaders in the Christian right may be interested or open to expelling the Palestinians from the West Bank, and that this poses a moral threat to Jews?
Well, first of all, there are some Jews who share that belief, too.
Yeah, true.
And secondly, again, one can welcome their support without agreeing 100% with everything that they say.
Yaakov, thanks for your call. Let's get another call. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes. I think both Ralph Reed, it's interesting, both Ralph Reed and Peter Bernhardt are politically savvy, and I think sometimes a little bit disingenuous as a result.
In what respect?
In the respect of, I mean, Peter Beinhart mentioned earlier that no Jew, no Israeli, no Zionist would ever, in good conscience, think about expelling the Palestinians.
I don't think he said exactly that, but I don't want to speak for him, but I don't think he was quite that sweeping.
Well, it wasn't with the tone of sarcasm in my voice.
But your point is then, Kevin?
But I think that we have to face that there is a strain of messianic Zionism in Israel, that it's disproportionately in the settler communities, that it's they also have, in because of the present state of the very delicate balance of power in the Knesset, they have to a certain extent a disproportionate say in determining if Sharon will stay in power or not.
So you're suggesting that this is in some respects an alliance of hardline radical fringes?
Just as these people who believe in the end times and they're working for the return of the Jews to Israel so they can be eventually raptured, and they're willing to make an alliance with them, which is, I can see, as very opening a can of worms potentially in the future, I also see the same kind of alliance with a certain strain of, I don't want to have the negative connotation, fanaticism, with a small minority in Israel that has a disproportionate influence in Israel presently.
We got it. Kevin, thank you for your call. Peter Beinart, how about it? Kevin heard you as saying that there were no Israelis who would favor expelling the Palestinians. And what about his further suggestion that there's a kind of alliance of interests here, in fact?
Well, no, I didn't say, I certainly didn't mean to say mm-hmm. that there are no Israelis. He's absolutely right. There is a messianic, a messianic strain. There has been within the Zionist tradition. It is, as he says, particularly strong amongst settlers who have a kind of messianic nationalist religious vision. But my point was that there is a long tradition of Israeli politics of keeping that out of the mainstream, of saying that is kind of the equivalent to what, you know, openly racist statements are in American politics. Mm-hmm. Do they exist? Of course they do. Do people share them? Of course they do. But that's precisely what makes it so important that mainstream leaders of the right and the left have said this is beyond the pale. And I think that that Israeli governments of the right and the left have in fact done that. Again, that's why even the extreme right party, a party called Moladet of the assassinated tourism minister Rehavam Zevi, never actually came out and said it supported physical transfer, because it has terribly negative connotations in the Israeli context. And my fear is that some Christian conservative leaders, and I would include Jerry Falwell in this, who said this as recently as April, either don't recognize that or don't think it's so bad.
Ralph Reed, we've just got a minute left. I want to get your sense of what everyone thinks of it. This alliance is very real. How do you interpret what its impact will be on U.S. policy toward Israel and in the Middle East?
Well, I think America and the United States have historically been pro-Israel on the one hand, very much so based on the reasons I've already walked through.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, I believe, one of the first nations to recognize the State of Israel upon its creation in 1948. But secondly, the United States has always had a role to play as an honest broker in the peace process. And I don't expect that policy to change.
Whether or not the Christian fundamentalist community is ardently pro-Israel, you mean?
Yeah, because I think the historical and diplomatic roots of that policy go back over many decades and for all kinds of geopolitical reasons. Having said that, however, I think that the, I wouldn't say the emerging alliance, but the emerging dialogue between the Jewish and Christian communities on this issue at this mm-hmm. moment of crisis mm-hmm. is interesting in two respects. First of all, it could create a constituency that could have the greatest impact on foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. And secondly, it offers a moment of opportunity in greater Christian and Jewish dialogue leading to mutual respect and understanding.
Ralph Reed, we're going to have to come back and talk about that with you on another evening. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Ralph Reed is chairman of the Georgia Republican Party, and Peter Beinart, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Peter Beinart is editor of the New Republic. Coming up, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and the Democratic strategy for November. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. With President Bush still riding high approval ratings, Democrats seem to be facing an uphill battle in this November's elections. In a speech at the National Press Club earlier today, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle unveiled some of the issues that Democrats will be playing up this fall in their effort to hold on to control of the Senate. He also called for an inquiry into any possible intelligence failure before September 11th. Here are excerpts from Daschle's speech.
Despite what some in the administration have suggested, silence in the face of security lapses is not patriotism. If anything, it is the opposite. And the consequences of such silence can be devastating. Let me be clear. No one has said that the president could have prevented the tragedy of September 11th. But by the same token, no one can take much comfort from the picture that has emerged of government agencies that seem totally out of sync with each other, or that it has taken 8 months to begin putting that picture together. We need to find out what breakdowns happened before September 11th so we can make sure that they never happen again. If that requires questions, we'll ask them. If it requires hearings, we'll hold them. And if Republicans will agree on an independent commission, we'll appoint one. Winning the war on terror, holding those who attack us as unaccountable, and preventing future terrorist attacks on our nation must and will remain our top priority. This is not about politics. This is about national security and the government's most fundamental responsibility. We're proud of the unity we've shown and the success we've had in fighting the war on terror and laying the foundation for stronger homeland security. That work is critical. It is not finished. And we will continue to work together to see that it continues. But those responsibilities, as critical as they are only part of what this Congress and this administration must do now. People need to know that their economic future, their retirement, is secure too. People need to know that their children can get a good education. They need to know that the air they breathe and the water they drink is safe. These are all critical parts of a secure future as well. Congress and the administration ought to be working just as hard and just as closely on these priorities as we are on winning the war on terrorism. Democrats and Republicans, at least in Washington, have dramatically different plans in every one of these areas. On Social Security, the baby boom is about to become the senior boom. The first wave of baby boomers will retire in 8 years. A year ago, we were on a path that would have enabled us to save Social Security, a path that really did put Social Security first. We still have time to return to that path. With the right leadership, we could pass a real social security reform plan, one that sets aside surpluses today to pay for retirement benefits tomorrow, updates the benefits and finds needed savings to put it down, put it on long-term sound footing. But we should not go down the privatization path, which will drain funds from Social Security and lead to cuts in benefits. On Medicare prescription drugs, we need to finish the job begun with Medicare's creation a generation ago and add an affordable, meaningful, and universal prescription drug benefit to that program. On education, the first bill the Senate passed under Democratic control was a bipartisan education reform bill, the No Child Left Behind Act. There are a lot of good things in the new law, including new accountability measures that are badly needed. President Bush signed it just 5 months ago. Unfortunately, the president's own budget for next year drastically underfunds it. The administration's budget actually eliminates 28 education programs and cuts 8 more from the very bill that he signed just 5 months ago. And it cuts a total of more than $1 billion from that overall authorization that was just part of law as recently as the end of last year. Finally, on the environment, Republicans and the administration have announced plans to rewrite the Clean Water Act to allow more pollutants in our water. On the Clean Air Act, the administration has delayed a requirement to reduce toxic emissions from a variety of industrial sources. Democrats will enforce and strengthen America's clean air and clean water laws and see that polluters, not taxpayers, pay when our environment is damaged.
Senate Majority Leader Democrat Tom Daschle speaking at the National Press Club earlier today. Jack Beattie, Tom Daschle says at the very top, talking about investigating what went on before 9/11, he says this is not about politics, this is about national security.
Yeah, this is the Democrats' way into that discussion. Last December, Karl Rove, you may remember, gave a speech to Republican operatives in which he said, let's run on the war. Let's use that as our issue. Mm-hmm. Well, talking about security and the security lapses is the Democrats' way to sort of make the war their issue. So I think
so. With that, both sides are armed in a way around the war issue.
I think so. I mean, I think that's what he's sort of saying here. And, you know, he's calling for an independent commission. So is the Weekly Standard magazine, conservative magazine. So are many people. So and, of course, that's exactly what Dick Cheney and the administration said on Sunday they don't want any part of. And on the other side, where he brings up the retirement security, education, the environment, he's reacting there to a GOP poll of just a couple of weeks ago that showed that these are the issues that people are interested about, especially prescription drugs, and that the war on terror ranks down third or fourth in what the public is you know, wants from Washington. Of course, that could change if there's another terrorist attack.
So investigate, but turn the debate to domestic issues.
I think that's exactly what he's trying to do here, and to try to parry the war with the, you know, secure, you know, well, how we were we ready before 9/11?
And we're right back to Social Security. 8 years, he points out, until the first baby boomers retire. That's making it real, I guess.
It sure is, and, you know, he's rightly saying that, of course, to privatize Social Security would require a cut in benefits. So that's a serious, he's right on there, and it's a part of the privatization young people haven't quite cottoned on to.
Elections, here we come. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.